live from the Third Coast. It is our time to focus on where genealogy and spirit connect, a time to focus on our connection with ourselves and our past. Here's your host, Susan E. King.
Hey, hey, everybody. It's another Tuesday, and I think we may have it all together this week. It's been a rough roller coaster January, so that month is over, thank goodness. We're starting a new month, and I think things are going to improve dramatically. I think I've changed every component of starting at the computer to the microphone. So here we go, and look forward to a great 2010 with everybody. You know, we started the show with the whole intent of bringing genealogy and spirituality together, and really, you know, to focus on those things that help us really become more in tune with both ourselves and our reality. And you know, over the last month, really the last 3 weeks, I think all of us, no matter what race, creed we are, have really felt such an entombment to what has been going on in Haiti, which, you know, has a very interesting history into and unto itself, and I think we'll be talking about that a little bit. But as we watched in horror, I think, as things unfolded there, and as we, you know, look to the whole concept, in my opinion, that I think we've probably witnessed one of the most natural holocausts in my lifetime, and I say natural. But in any event, one of the things that really hit me, and I'm sure has hit everybody else, is, you know, how so many people lived and have died, and where there is no history of these lives that were lost 3 weeks ago, I guess today, maybe 4 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago today. And I think that at the end of the day, one of the things that really got me going into genealogy back about 27 years ago, 30 years ago, and I bet you my guests will share that with you as well, is the fact that we all come onto this earth and we all live, and at some point we all go. And we would hope, and one would hope, that there is some documentation of our lives and our history, and that history that can be passed on to future generations. And that really was what piqued my interest in genealogy so many years ago. And while my background obviously is in the Jewish genealogy, you know, we're celebrating Black History Month, I think, throughout the United States this month, in fact, started yesterday. So I couldn't think of a better way to do that than to bring probably one of my foremost cohorts in crime, I think, Valencia. We've been at this kind of in tandem over the last 20-some-odd years, in the African-American genealogy field. And that's Valencia King Nelson, and no relation, Valencia, but that's okay. We go back many, many years. Valencia, actually, and I'm going to let her tell a little bit about it, but is one of the original creators and founders of what is now Afrogenius. And you can find that at www.afrogenius.com, and that's AFRIGENEAS.com. And we kind of hooked up together many years ago when the organization I was with, Jewish Gen, put together a mailing list, and I helped the then African-American group get a mailing list on the Internet, and we're going back Wayback Machine. So let's welcome Valencia King Nelson. And Valencia, a little bit about your history with genealogy.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. I started in genealogy over 40 years ago, and as you say, with no history, there is no future. And I'm just glad to be a part of that. And yes, we have gone back quite a long way, almost 30 years. You say 27? Well, I won't dispute that.
Well, maybe it was 27 2 years ago.
I won't dispute
that.
We're
scaring about aging ourselves. I don't know.
Well, we started way back, what we now call Afrogenus, started way back with Prodigy, where we had a small forum just meeting occasionally, and then we grew into AOL when Prodigy got too expensive for us. And we had a presence there with chat sessions going, starting on Saturday nights. And then it just expanded to there. And now here we are today on the internet with many, many viewers a day doing social networking and enjoying that.
Isn't it terrific what's happened to genealogy with the advent of the internet? I don't think without the internet that any of us would have been able to grow our organizations as we have grown them over these last, how many years? 30 years or so.
Actually a miracle when we think about it. I think about all the column pads I used to record stuff before we could really see what the census was like. It's a miracle what we are doing today.
It really is. And, you know, it's even getting better because of, you know, yeah, the digitization of books and Kindling and things like that. And, you know, genealogy may be one of the few industries that's really going green, you know, so to speak.
It's truly green.
It is green. Yeah, now if we could get our book publishers to go green, and I've been talking to one of them today about kindling some of those huge reference books, which would be really cool. And
that would be excellent.
Wouldn't that be cool to have
these
bookshelves just full of stuff? But in any event, let's talk a little bit about African-American genealogy, because, you know, like Jewish genealogy and other ethnic genealogies, it all comes with its own set of issues. Irish genealogy is totally different than doing Jewish genealogy, and is totally different than doing Native American genealogy and doing African American genealogy. So, in your opinion, some of the biggest pitfalls that people fall into when they first get started in African-American genealogy, what would those be?
Well, I would say all of the genealogies that we do are the same as far as the standards go. We have to start with ourselves, have to start with me in the present, and work backwards. That doesn't change regardless of what the ethnicity may be. Would you agree?
Pretty much. I mean, it's just a matter of how you can find information. I mean, you know, in Jewish genealogy, for example, there's a big hole because so many, especially American Jewish families, they immigrated and very little was left in the old country. So we have big gaps of information that, we've tried for these last 30 years or so to try to find and bring as much of that to the forefront as we can. But, you know, African-American genealogy, we have the whole issue of slavery and how information and records were recorded during the periods of slavery.
Yes, well, that's what I'm saying. We begin with, still in the present, we begin with who the individual is and work backwards. And when we get to 1870, It's all the same from, say, 1830, if we're going through the census, to 1870. Past 1870, there is a period of slavery prior to emancipation. And that's where the problem comes, because the people who were enslaved were not keeping records. The records were kept by slave owners. At the same time, we must recognize that there were a group of people who were never enslaved. They were free, or they became free, or they were called by some people, some authors, slaves without masters, because they still had the issue of skin color, which made them stand out in the population that was primarily white. The big gap that you talk about comes from the beginning of the nation to the end of the Civil War. Go ahead.
That's okay. As the Jewish immigrants, for example, we have in most cases a lot of passenger records. When you go back to when the slaves were brought from Africa to America or the Americas, I don't know if the records were kept that you could even begin to trace your ancestry back to Africa and to the whole country. I mean, the documents just aren't there.
Well, as I said, the enslaved people themselves were, of course, not keeping records, but records were kept because it was an economic thing. And wherever economy is involved, you know there must be a record, because
right.
We're talking about the bottom line. So trying to trace back to Africa or whatever country these people may have been migrated or imported from is not that easy. It's possible, but it's not easy. And there are some people who have been quite successful in doing that. We have one of the people who helps manage the Afrigenius location website. In fact, it's our reunion manager, who has been successful in tracing his family Africa, West Africa. And so it's quite possible, but it's not easy, because one must go through the manifest of the ships and try to know that a person who was picked up in West Africa, who was named Cato at the time, is now William, or was the person that we have identified as William. And that takes a lot of hard work. It also takes finding the owner, so-called, of the person who was enslaved, and try and get them to share their records with the researcher. Sometimes that's difficult, sometimes it's very, very easy. And it, again, depends on the mindset of the person who's holding the records, because the records are there, but they were kept by the people who were doing the trading, doing the buying, doing the work of the person who was enslaved.
So what you're really saying, and this is intriguing to me, is that, you know, going back, if you found an owner and you found in the 1850 slave schedule, for example, that a Jones family, for example, owned, you know, five slaves and had the names of these five slaves, which are usually just first names from what I have seen, then you could try to trace back to the Jones family and see if there are any records within that family. Is that how you do it?
Well, one thing that happens is we look at wills and estates.
Okay.
And go from there, because there you have inventories, and the inventories will name the individuals who are part of that estate. And frequently you will find that there is a surname, and the surname is not necessarily that of the so-called owner. It becomes a little bit easier when there's a surname, and there's a lot of literature in support of surnames. I didn't bring any with me today. I don't have a reference, but we can talk about that maybe at another time when it comes to researching the period of enslavement.
Okay. That would be interesting because, I mean, this is obviously it's not something that I have done.
Right.
And so I'm like the audience, pretty much, I guess a little green in that area, but interested because, you know, I do a little bit of research, for people that have actually owned slaves. So, I've seen some of those records, but I've been searching the other side of the coin.
Right. Well, so what I'm saying is that it's all possible. It's not easy, but it is possible.
So if I was a listener and, with a, African-American background, what would be the first steps that you would suggest that I take if I wanted to begin, to do research on my family?
Well, the first thing, as I said initially, is to begin with yourself and trace back one generation at a time, using the census as a guidepost. After you have done the research at home in the attic and in the basement and all of those records that one finds in the community, we call it talking to the griot, and that's G-R-I-O-T. And the griot is anybody in the community who remembers the history. Hopefully it's in one's own family, but it may not be. And that's why we are more into this thing of community genealogy, because we look at everybody in the community as being kin some way. If not community kin, as we go backward, it's plantation kin. So I would encourage a person to try and start using the census after they've done the research at home of gathering information, photographs, whatever, and work backwards to 18 and 70. And from 18 and 70, and if you've documented everything from there, which is a hard job, as you know.
Yes.
And then there are some records that we would find that the general genealogist may not need to find because it may be easier because the records were kept looking at what the future would be for their descendants.
Well, very much like, Jewish research, a lot of the big commercial genealogy companies that are online have also begun to put a lot of new information online, such as Ancestry.com, Footnote.com. And there's a lot of African-American genealogy information there as well. Is there anything on those sites that you, besides the census, that you would think would be very important for someone?
Oh, yes, all of the records that are there. In fact, there is a new partnership that AfroGenius has with ProQuest. ProQuest in July of 09, initiated an African-American heritage project that's available through libraries.
Okay.
And it is in that we are trying to get every possible record, wherever it exists, that uses the term black, African, Afro, colored, Negro, slave, whatever the term may be. And all of those are in a special project, as I mentioned, called the African American Heritage.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And it's excellent that we have that available. It's not full-blown yet, but it's on its way, and it's just marvelous. One of the things we have there are the Freedmen Bank records that go back to the end of the Civil War. The Freedmen Bank only existed, I think, for about 7 years, but the records there are absolutely perfect to see because they not only show historically what happened economically with people who were trying to save a little money to buy a little piece of property that was instituted by the federal government. It didn't last that long, and it wasn't successful because a lot of people, as happens with banks right now, made off with some of the monies. However, those records specify whole families, previous owners, employment, and physical descriptions of the depositor. So those are outstanding to have.
Oh, my goodness. And, you know, when you talk about records and things like this, I mean, one of the things, and we talked about this briefly, I think, offline when we were talking in the last week or so, is, you know, one of the most important things that all of us can do, whether we're genealogists, historians, or just members of a community, is to try to make sure that these records are preserved. I mean, we look at, you know, what has happened in Haiti over the last 3 weeks, which, you know, these people share the same heritage, I'm sure. Correct me if I'm wrong, as do a lot of African Americans. They just didn't get as far. But, you know, the ship stopped, I guess, and before it came to the mainland. But you know, so, you know, the fear that the records in Haiti, you know, may have been totally lost and destroyed, you know, it could be a, you know, a whole history and a whole culture and a whole people that, you know, may be lost, you know, forever. So not only do we have the emotional, you know, trauma of seeing what we see on the news, every day, of these families and these orphans and the people, bodies that have been disposed of in the mass graves, which, you know, is very reminiscent for me to what happened during the Holocaust. But, you know, the records are gone. And, you know, I don't know what it's going to take, and I'm sure that's the last thing on people's minds right now, but at some point in near future, it's going to be something that I think, you know, is going to need to be addressed at some point. Because, again, it would totally lost history. It's, you know, people not being buried. There are no tombstones. There's no markers. There are no graves. There's no records of somebody's life. And
that is a big hole. But it will be interesting to, as we wait to see what happens when the rubble clears, what records do remain. As you know, in Katrina, we thought all the records were gone, but many records remain, even though that was something of a Holocaust, the Katrina disaster.
Right. Well, you know, you're talking about my hometown, so,
okay.
Gosh.
All right.
And, you know, we lived right here on the Third Coast. We lived through Ike a year or so ago, and there were some communities that were totally devastated there as well. So, you know, this is something, I guess, from the historical and genealogical perspective, we look to, too, because it certainly is frightening, which means to the audience out there that it's critical that all of us do our research and we preserve our history and we do it and we do it now and we engage our children and we engage our families. And one of the things that we recommend, and you know, I think that even in African American genealogy as well, is one of the best sources is interviews and family interviews. And you know, I can't tell you how many times I hear from people, gosh, I wish I'd asked my mother.
Oh, I wish I had listened to my grandmother.
I think we hear it all the time.
All the time.
I am fortunate. I have a brother that actually listened to my grandmother, and I tell you the stories he tells me that she told him. You know, and I keep thinking to myself, and I'm going to do this, is I'm going to sit him down on Skype, and we're just going to record the heck out of those
they
stories.
Get it all down.
Yeah, because he has it in his head, but that's about as far as most of them went. So interview is one of the key things. And, you know, one of the things that I have found, and I'm going to pass this on to you and the audience, is there is a free program out there called Audacity, Audacity. And you can actually install it on your computer and push a record button if you're talking on Skype or even if on a speakerphone, and it will record the whole conversation. And you have an
give me that name again.
I will do that. It's Audacity, Audacity.
Audacity, okay.
Yeah, just
I'm making a note of that.
www.audacity.com.
Okay.
So that's a great tool that I use, you know, quite frequently, and especially when I'm interviewing clients, and sometimes when I'm interviewing family members of clients, because if that hasn't been done, it has to get done.
Okay. Well, as you speak of interviews, that's another resource that we have in the African American research community, are ex-slave interviews that was done as a part of the WPA project under the Roosevelt administration, where people were sent out as part of the economic need to interview ex-slaves or their descendants. And all of those are recorded and are now online.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's phenomenal.
So what's called the slave narratives are just an excellent source for many. One of the problems with them is that some of them were recorded in the so-called dialect of the interviewee, and they may be difficult to read, but they have been translated from the dialect into standard English in many instances. But it provides a big clue to many people in finding family.
Now, that's interesting. You mentioned dialect. I mean, I come from New Orleans. I mean, I grew up with Creole. I mean, it's the same kind of thing that we hear when we watch the news about Haiti. Is that basically what we're talking about, is the Creole language?
It's sort of a Creole or a Pidgin or a Patois, as it's called. Anything that's non-standard to the English, United States English language, which is sort of a Patois in itself when we think of the, I guess, European language.
Well, I'm learning a lot, so so where would these people have been that were talking in these different dialects? I mean, all over the nation?
Mostly all over the nation. But as you know, if you go back to the beginning of where we came from, the Atlantic slave trade was triangular from Africa to South America to the United States. And so that's a triangle that you see going. It went into Asia. So the people from Africa were transported to all of those other countries and nations. And we think of the person coming from Africa, say, going into South America, Brazil, those parts, being seasoned, being brought up through to the Caribbean, and then brought into South Carolina. That's generally what we think of, what's now known as South Carolina. Then that portion of what we call the United States was owned by the British and the French, as you know, all of this prior to the Louisiana Purchase.
Right. So, you know, going back, the history of Haiti, then, and the people of Haiti, I don't know how much of Haitian history you might know, but these are the same people that came from Africa through South America, through the Caribbean, and as I mentioned earlier, they were the ones that ended up not coming as far as mainland America, correct?
Oh, they did. Some of them did. As I say, they went to South America, and I include Caribbean in South America, before coming into South Carolina, Virginia, and other ports where they had been conditioned previously, because the one serious thing about the period of enslavement is the separation of families. People were wiped away from their families or stolen away from their families. But as we do the research, we see reconnects of people who were sold off who do go back and find their family members.
And that's what this whole thing in Haiti is about, is in the fear of trafficking these children and separating, you know, would-be orphans from their families, when in fact maybe they are not orphans at all. I mean, that concerns me a lot. I mean, while I believe very strongly that if a child is orphaned and they can be offered a better home, I'm all for that. But separating family members, when they should not be separated, to me, I mean, having seen what happens to families through the Holocaust and as you have through enslavement, I mean, that is one of the most traumatic experiences an individual can have.
That is very traumatic. The thing about research, however, is that using traditional methods and classical methods of research, what I call classic methods of research, one can do reconnects. And just one reconnect is encouraging for others to follow the same methods to do the same thing. Now, of course, the problem is working right here in the present, again, from the 1930 census to 18 and 70, to try and do as much connecting and documenting in there, and not just with the hope of making a family tree, as so many say, well, I just want to make a family tree because I'm going to have a reunion, but to try and encourage people on a community level to research the family and do as you suggest, that there not be a loss of all of the history when there is a disaster, because we know we have had disasters and there will be disasters. It's not just Haiti or Ike or whatever the natural problem may be. No, it is not. I mean, you know, one of the things I think I heard on television that kind of perked my interest a little bit is that, you know, the Israelis were some of the first on the scene in Haiti. And they claim that they are so well trained because the Middle East is sitting on a fault themselves, yes,
waiting for disaster.
Yes, yes.
And I guess that was something that was new information for me. I don't think I had ever thought or knew about that. So
about that. Well, I lived in Santa Barbara, California, for a number of years and sat right on the San Andreas Fault. And then had to also deal with the Santa Ana winds and the fires that followed. So we are surrounded by a stream of disasters periodically wherever we are geographically. And Haiti is indeed a Holocaust. But we just, that's preparing us for the next one that may come. And perhaps you mentioned the word preservation. Perhaps now we need to think about preservation and to look at what resources are possible in this digital age for preserving things in the cloud, as the Apple people like to say. Put it in the cloud and it will always be there. So that's another thing that we perhaps have to try and foster as we do the research. It's preserving it not in a bank somewhere, but in the ether around the internet. What do you think of that?
Well, I think a lot of that. You know, I don't think I've mentioned this to you, but one of my colleagues and I have a data brokerage firm, and what we are trying to do is talk to people who have not considered using quote-unquote the cloud as a means to share some of their archival collections to start thinking about it. And, you know, we're working with many of the providers out there that to try to strike the best possible working solution for both parties. And I believe very strongly in that. And there are a lot of people that, you know, still maintain a fear of having information on the Internet. And while I'm all for privacy, I'm also for preservation. And it's a matter of making a separation of preservation and privacy. That's a tough one, but...
It's tough because the privacy thing is utmost. But as we look around today, how much privacy is there? And what is really privacy all about? What are we hiding when we talk about privacy? I'm not sure.
I know.
But it's really important to have the preservation, and certainly the Internet and the company you just mentioned is an avenue to that preservation.
Right. You know, and there are records that have never seen the light of day where you have to go to Israel or points way beyond if you wanted to even... get your hands on the information. And in today's age and time, you know, we've got to get over that. And, you know, people have got to realize that it's time to, you know, find ways, to put, you make the information available to the largest groups of audience. Cause, you know, if we don't have the information, we certainly can't preserve our family history.
And that's one of the things I would say, Susan, as far as researching the period of enslavement, are the private records that are in the hands of the descendants of the slaveholders or the slave owners, and those terms are interchangeable, and make them available, not to hide them. Send them to AfroGenius.com, and we will make them available to all of the people who are trying to make that link from the present to the past. Also, the records that we do, when we get to that period of enslavement, it is necessary for the African-American researcher to research the slaveholding family. And often we uncover more information because we do study those wills and the estates so seriously that we can help the descendant of the slaveholding family to find their ancestors as well.
So there really is a lot of working together that really needs to happen between the African-American genealogy community and the genealogy community who at one time had families that own slaves. And, you know, a lot of times I hear people are, you know, there are a lot of people that really are, what's the word? Embarrassed, you know, that their families were slave owners and they don't even want to talk about it. And, you know, I guess maybe we do need to do some work to encourage people to, you know, say, hey, it's okay. I mean, that is history. That's part of the past. You know, let's get it out in the open. Let's, you know, preserve that part of history and make the information as available to both sides of the coin. You know, I mean, we're all a people, you know, as one.
Yes.
Slightly different histories and slightly different connections on different sides of the fence. But, you know, working together, we can preserve, you know, really, yeah, the history for you know, two different distinct types of people.
And for all generations. And actually, the history quite often is the same. The bloodlines differ, although sometimes the bloodlines connect. But the history actually is the same because the lives were interchanged. If one reads, I would refer your audience to Slaves in the Family, and that's work by Ed Ball, a descendant of a slave-owning family. And he does an excellent job of showing that the history is the same. I kind of laugh sometimes when we talk about Black History Month, because from where I sit, Black history is American history, and American history is Black history, because it was the slaves who built America to a great extent.
That's so very true.
Okay.
But I only did that because it is.
Yes.
I didn't create that. I
oh,
hear
no,
you.
No, no.
I hear you.
Uh-huh. Just, when we talk of history, everybody shares the same history to some extent. What we don't always share is the bloodline, and that's where the search is for, looking for that bloodline. And, of course, DNA, we didn't even talk about the miracle of DNA and what that does in terms of the research potential and the finding potential.
Right. And, I mean, you know, I've had Bennett Greenspan from Family Tree DNA on my show numerous times, and I think we've got him booked again for March 9th. But, Bennett and I go back before genealogy, actually. He and I did business together when we were both running two other types of companies.
Okay.
When he had this figment of that imagination on that particular side, he and I sat down for lunch one day, and he told me about what he was thinking, and my eyes just popped out of my head, and I guess gave him, as he says, the impetus to move on. And Family Tree DNA, in my opinion, has turned out to be probably one of the finest DNA companies for genealogical testing in the world. So I am partial to them, but from what I can see, I think that moving forward and having been there, that they have probably done an outstanding job in moving DNA testing and genealogy forward. Let's talk about how DNA impacts African American genealogy.
I'm not as up on the DNA. I see the process, and we have a forum that talks about DNA. There is a gentleman by the name of Rick Kittles who operates a DNA project based in Howard University in Washington, D.C., and a lot of conversation. I have not done DNA myself. I plan to do that, but I keep putting it off because it gets a little bit expensive. But it works very well, and there are many people who've made many discoveries, and one of the discoveries is, as far as the Y DNA is concerned, a large percent of it comes back showing European heritage.
Correct.
The Y DNA.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, the Y DNA is really more anthropological than it is genealogical, where the Y has been more genealogical. And, I think in time things will change where, DNA will be DNA and it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman, your DNA will have some value.
DNA
has no value in genealogical research.
That was just something out yesterday about that, about it being a one DNA rather than separating the Y from the mtDNA.
Yes.
But I'm still on the sidelines. I'm not over into it yet, so I'm really not that clear on what I'm speaking of.
Yeah. Before we keep going, we're getting close to the end of the hour. If anybody has any questions for Valencia or myself for that matter, the toll-in number is 888-815-9756. Topic is African American genealogy. If you have any questions, want to get started, now's the time to call in and get some ideas from the expert herself. A lot of times, the DNA testing has been very surprising for a lot of people, and a lot of people that have gone in and gotten DNA testing are finding a lot of white blood in them and a lot of white people are finding black blood in them.
Yes.
And then you've got a lot of the Native Americans that are finding a little bit of everything in them.
Yes.
And, you know, I would say to anyone out there that is interested in DNA is you need to be prepared for some surprises because it does not lie. History and family stories may lie and may tell, you know, may not come forth with the truth, but DNA testing does not lie. And it is, it's very exciting. I mean, I have a couple of adoption cases that I've taken on, including a brother who's adopted who we just had his DNA tested, and it's pretty exciting. I mean, he was getting chills when he first read the results of his test because he really didn't know what his primary heritage was. I mean, we knew that he had some Jewish blood in him, but not to the extent that we have found that he has Jewish blood. And there are more connections on his side and with the DNA testing in the first week than there are with my natural brother's in the 10 years that we've had his DNA in the pot. So
Okay. It's
really very interesting. And especially if you really don't know where you came from,
it's
really very exciting stuff. And I think that over time and as years progress, DNA is going to be an even better tool for connecting families. And, you know, we started, although there were lots of other people, but, you know, when Family Tree DNA first started, I mean, there was an original focus on Jewish lines because we had the paper trail that ended very quickly, during those time periods in the last century. And, it was one of the only means to try to see if there were families with the same surname that would connect. And no paper. I mean, no paper. So, in any event, it's exciting, and I think in any type of ethnic, research that, DNA it should be included as a major piece of the genealogical puzzle.
Absolutely, and you're absolutely correct that all ethnic genealogy and history has its special challenges, although we begin on the same foot. Of starting with oneself and working backwards. We can't change that. We don't want to change that. But at the same time, when we get to certain periods, there are holes and gaps that are wide, but are narrowing based on our skills as researchers and the availability of those records that we don't hold ourselves or didn't create ourselves, but were created in our behalf or on our behalf. Now, when we come to these natural disasters, that's another thing. And the preservation, I think, is the key. And I think this digital era that we're in makes preservation more likely for records than not likely. And so perhaps we need to begin some focus on that, as you mentioned you are trying to do right now. And I would like to somehow join you in that.
Well, we will probably join together because I think it's just so very critical, both on a spiritual basis for me as well as a genealogical basis. I can't stand lost lives in the history, lost forever without, it just bothers me. I mean, I don't know if we ever talked, Valencia, and I think I shared this with the audience on maybe one occasion before, but the whole reason I got started in genealogy was to going to the gravesite of my great-great-grandfather, and there were, him and his wife, of course, and then there were five other people.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at my dad, and I said, "Dad, who are these people?" And he looked at me, he says, "I have no clue." And it was that instant that I realized that I felt a need inside of me to go find out who these people were.
Uh-huh.
And who, you know, who were they? I mean, you know, they are bloodlines. They're connected to me, you know, and nobody in my family knew they ever existed. That bothered me.
And so that got you going.
That is the single incident that got me going. Was a visit to the cemetery and finding all these people buried in the same plot, and nobody knew who they were. What got you going?
Well, what got me going is that I never knew a grandparent.
None?
Many of my cousins, look like everybody that I went to school with, had a grandmother or a grandfather, so I was always searching for this grandparent. And, of course, I was born in 1928, and those of us born at that time grew up with children should be seen and not heard. So one did not ask questions, but I always had the question, why am I claiming somebody else's grandmother is mine or somebody else's grandfather is mine? So I began the search for my own grandparents, and that's what got me hooked.
And what was the reason? Have you found the answers?
Oh, yeah, I did find my grandparents.
Okay.
And even great-grandparents, and I'm still searching. So I was determined that my children would not have that question about who their grandparents were. So that kept me involved, and then I decided to do it on a community basis, and that's where I am right now in doing community genealogy.
Wonderful.
I now live in a retirement community, and I've gotten the some of the people here interested and involved in telling the story so their children will have the stories of their history if they ever decide to do this community genealogy that I'm trying to promote right now.
You know, that's incredible. And, you know, and it's not just, you know, people in retirement communities that need to be involved. It's those with young children that need to be involved. And, you know, genealogy is a family affair, in my opinion.
It is.
And there
is
nothing out there that can bring a family together on a project than to begin to, you know, document a family, and for grandparents and parents and children to work together and to have something to share and to talk about. And what's even more exciting to me, despite it all, I don't know about you, Valencia, but I hated history. I hated geography. I hated politics. I hated all those things when I was growing up and going to school. And suddenly, in my search, you know, in using genealogy, I had to become interested in history. I had to become interested in politics and what was going on in the world during these time periods that I was searching. I had to become interested in geography and where places were. And, you know, in Jewish research, you know, it's even more complicated because the borders changed, the names changed, and names were pronounced in, you know, sometimes Polish, Russian, or Yiddish, and, you know, he tried to figure out what town is what.
Yes.
So, you know, all of a sudden, all these things that I had absolutely no interest in suddenly became very important. And, you know, as parents out there, I cannot encourage you more to involve your children in a project like this and allow them to grow and to, you know, take those classes that they're taking with a deeper meaning and a deeper sense of purpose and a deeper sense of self and a deeper, you know, awareness of who they are and how they fit into the world at large. So that's my soapbox, and I'll get off.
I join you on that soapbox. And it's been so delightful talking with you, and I hope we can do this again so we can do more than just scratch the surface.
We will certainly do that, and I'll be in touch, and we'll figure out some of the topics that might be worth covering. And I think it's so very important that, you know, that no matter what ethnic background you come from, that you know that there is a way, and especially in today's world, I mean, the information that we have at our fingertips today versus what it was when Nancy and I first started 30 years ago or more,
yes,
is millions and earth years away from where it was. And, you know, the information is there. People are out there sharing their information on numbers of websites, some free, some not free. But, you know, if you do your research, it's important to get it out and get it shared and let people connect with you, and you will never know what wonders can present themselves to you. I want to tell you a funny story, Valencia, before we go, because I've been on a search, obviously, for many years, and I have a family that was Spanish, and I think they immigrated to Latvia after the Inquisition, and they came to the U.S. In the early 1850s, and they came through Veracruz and into New Orleans, and then from New Orleans over here to Galveston, Texas. And, you know, for years, you know, we have been trying to find out what this Mexican connection was.
Uh-huh.
And my great-grandfather's brother was in the diamond business, we believe, and his kids were born all over South America. My cousin just found something in a book about this great-great-great uncle being involved in some business down in Mexico City, and they absconded and they took all of his assets and they kicked him out of Mexico and wouldn't allow him to return. And I'm not going to tell the full story because now I can't remember exactly what it was. But I mean, it was just written in this book that we found on Google, or he found on Google. My cousin found it.
Uh-huh.
And it was just, you know, I said, well, isn't that interesting?
That's so amazing.
You know, you just, and then, you know, we're talking about people that lived, that were born in the 1830s and died in the 1890s. And, you know, there is information out there, and it's becoming widely available. And one of the best sources that I have found is Google Books. Have you looked on Google Books?
Oh, it's an excellent source.
If you've got a family out there, you know, just go to Google and type in, you know, King family from, you know, Culpeper, Virginia, and then click on the web or options and go down to books and click on yes, and you might be amazed at the amount of information that's available in book form that can be either downloaded in some cases you have to buy them, which is early documentations that may have been written in, you know, the turn of the century, 1900s, 1910, 1930s, where they have already done these genealogies, and they are just a wealth of information.
That's true.
For everybody.
That's true.
Well, I thank you for
joining us. And I thank you for inviting me.
And I told you this wasn't so difficult, did I?
It wasn't difficult at all.
I love that laugh. I just wanted to make her laugh. I really did, because she's got such a beautiful, soft, sweet voice, and the laugh just comes from the heart and from the spirit. Valencia King Nelson, thank you for joining me today. Again, you can find Afrogenius at www.afrogenius.com, and that's AFRIGENEAS.com. And we look forward to seeing you in the coming weeks. We got some exciting guests lined up. I'm going to surprise you, but we'll be talking about astrology. We're going to be talking about Native American lineage. We're going to be talking about DNA again. And we're going to be talking about other social networking websites for the genealogical community. We got a lot in store for you for 2010. We look forward to seeing you next week.
You have been listening to Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect with Susan E. King. Each week we will focus on the spiritual journey of connecting ourselves with our ancestors. Join us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. For upcoming show information, you can visit Susan's website at www.susaneking.com.